for some historical background here, I wonder if you could, in a very small nutshell, put the question of anti-Origenism on the table. We know that in Origen's time and just after his time, you had authors like Jerome writing in Latin in the Western Empire, condemning Origen, saying he's heretical for this and that reason. So that's a kind of anti-Originist strain in Christianity. But people talk about the first and second anti-Originisms and stuff like this. So can you explain that, like, sort of historical terminology to give a framework to what's going on?
Yeah. Well, Origen's writings and thought drew detractors from the very beginning. We see that in his own works where he defends himself and tries to explain certain doctrines. But after he died, the party kept on going. And we have the writings of a number of detractors, earliest being Methodius of Olympus and probably others in that ambit, because we have an apology by an early 4th century writer named Pamphilius, who is the teacher of Eusebius, who wrote 5 books defending Origen from certain charges. In a sense, I would love to know more about this period, because I think that would probably be properly called the first Originist controversy. But the title of the first Originist controversy is usually reserved for the events of the 390s, in which you have an all-star cast of Rufinus, John of Jerusalem on one side, pitted against Epiphanius and Jerome on the other, with Theophilus of Antioch being in the middle and moving from the Originists over to the anti-Originists with rather devastating consequences for the legacy. But after that brief period, 390s into the probably about 410, 415, we don't hear anything more. Throughout the 5th century, it is relatively quiet. In fact, those sources that have anything to say, at least about Evagrius, who I've studied most in this context, have nothing but praise for him. And one gets the impression that in the 5th century, the majority of it, all is well. And even up into the early 6th century. But then Justinian comes to the throne, and things change in so many different ways, as has already been unpacked very well in this podcast. And I believe that Originism is one of those things that changes on a dime with the rise of Justinian. In fact, there's evidence from one of Gabriel Bunga's recent books in which he says that the addition of the Apophthegmata Patrum, the Sayings of the Desert Fathers, seems to have been changed right around the beginning of Justinian's reign, because there are some very complementary things that survive in the Latin translation of the Apophthegmata that do not appear in the Greek version. And this editing work would have been done around the same time that Justinian came right to power.
It's like Stalin editing those photos of himself with the early Bolsheviks and like taking out Bolsheviks one at a time, you know, like they weren't there.
Yeah. Something like that. And the sources are very murky, but we do know that there was strife between Originists and non-Originists, particularly in the monasteries of Palestine. And this is best accounted, described to us in a work by Cyril of Scythopolis called The Lives of the Monks of Palestine, in which he basically recalls a lot of the politics within the monasteries during the 530s and 540s. And Cyril, very sharp critic of Origen and Originists, blames Justinian's right-hand man, Theodore Ascetus, who is titular bishop of Cappadocia, for purging the monasteries in Palestine and replacing the leadership with pro-Originist monks and abbots. One gets the impression from Cyril that might have felt like the end of the world, as if all true orthodoxy was being removed from the monasteries. And when he gets to what we know is the Fifth Ecumenical Council, he describes it essentially as a triumph over Originism. And he has very little to say about what later records show to be the topic of the Fifth Ecumenical Council, which is the three chapters controversy. That is Theodore, Mopsuestia, Ibas, and Theodoret of Kyrus. Well, Cyril has an agenda, and he shapes his account in a particular way. It's very valuable because he's writing in the year 554 or 555, very, very close to the time of the events, but he's not quoting from conciliar documents or anything like that. For those sorts of descriptions about what happened during Origins, then we have to turn to other later historians or chronicles. And personal preference, what I think is the most balanced account, comes from Evagrius Scholasticus, 7th century church historian, who discusses both the three chapters and the Originist controversy in 553, and describes the Originist anti-Originist move as something that came out in the 8th and final session of what was otherwise an attempt to deal with the three chapters. And it seems that some of the monks of Palestine, the anti-Originist monks, managed to get a delegation to Constantinople, and they made charges in that final session against the Originists, something that had got slipped onto the agenda, or placed onto the agenda, with Justinian's permission and probably encouragement. The charges are said to have the monks are said to have lodged libelloi, a libellus, a defamation against the Originists, and then Justinian endorsed it with a letter to the synod asking them to deal with it, and the synod had. Basically, they issued what something called an anaphora. Not clear exactly what that is, but some sort of ecclesiastical legal thing, reporting back on what they found. And that's kind of the end of what Evagrius says. He doesn't mention anything about anathemas, although he does say that three people were condemned: Evagrius, Didymus the Blind, and Theodore of Ascetus, all of whom were quoted during this period. For the anathemas themselves, no one knew anything that there were such a thing as 15 anathemas against Origen until they were discovered in a manuscript in the late 17th century. A single manuscript. And we have only one manuscript for these 15 anathemas.
Yeah, and this is where things start to get really interesting and the work you're bearing on. So remind me, this is the Second Ecumenical Council. No, Fifth Ecumenical Council, Second Council of Constantinople. Is that right?
That's right. That's right.
It's in 548?
It's in 553.
53, thank you. 553.
And it's come 10 years after a Constantinopolitan synod that condemned Origen. These are the so-called 9 or 10 anathemas of 543.
Got it. So we've had two blasts of anti-Origen official church council stuff. Now, an anathema is, in this church context, is a statement along the lines of, if someone believes, or if someone says that the human soul pre-exists the body, let him be anathema, meaning let him be outside the pale of orthodoxy, right? And so it's like a kind of formal statement. So we have now a big collection of anti-Originist anathemas. But so for the Second Council, Second Council of Constantinople, 553, what's often called Justinian's anti-Originist Council, which, as you say, wasn't centered on Origen, but for our purposes, this delegation of monks or whatever managed to slip in the anti-Originist agenda. This is where we have to ask, what does Originism mean, right? Because a lot of this has to do with Evagrius.
Yes.
Or...
And his readers.
And his readers, right.
Because this is dealing with 6th century politics, and especially the monasteries in Palestine.
Yeah.
There's a sense in which everything that happened in 553 was catalyzed by Palestinian monasteries. The three chapters were, in a sense, heroes of those who opposed Originism. And, of course, the Origen, Evagrius, and Didymus the Blind were the heroes of the Originists. So both parties in it, the way I read it, both parties engineered in Constantinople the kind of apparatus to condemn each other's right. heroes
yeah.
and get the upper hand.
So in that polemical discussion, I think it's just important to point out, because this was very confusing to me for a long time in trying to get my head around all this stuff, that the term Originism is... I don't think we should assume that the people, the monks of Palestine who are reading all this stuff and doing their form of Christianity, were calling themselves Originists, right? Or even that necessarily Origen is the key figure in this tradition. This is a tradition that, as you say, goes back at least to Clement in many of its important respects. It's a Christian tradition that, I mean, maybe we can trace it to Alexandria originally, but which has spread throughout the Eastern Mediterranean. And it's, you can describe it as Platonizing in this, or Platonistic in the sense that it uses a lot of ideas that are not necessarily there to be found in Christian scriptures, but which can be traced back eventually to Plato, which are being used to explain what Christian scriptures are about, right? So drawing on a Hellenic philosophical heritage to make sense of Christianity. That is something that these authors all seem to have in common. But are they Originists? Not really.
Well,
right?
In the eyes of their opponents, they
right.
are.
So that's the polemical construction. So when we describe these people as Originists and say the Originists fought back against the soi-disant Orthodox, we yeah. don't mean to imply that the Originists are calling themselves Originists and waving a flag with Origen's name on it or anything like that. They're
right. Yeah. Yeah. We don't know how they would have described themselves, or even how they would have described their own opponents.
Right.
All we have is the rhetorical reflections of somebody like Cyril of Scythopolis, who also attests, interestingly, to a schism that developed among the Originists of his time, such that they began fighting with each other and calling each other by names. So one side called the other Protochrists, and the other side called the other Isochrists. What those particular names meant and their differences in doctrine were left to speculate. We do not know. It's said that Theodore of Ascetus was in the party of the Isochrists.
Right. I mean, the name would imply that they were claiming in some way to be equal to Christ, or that perhaps once the resurrection occurs, the saved will become equal to or even one with Christ, right?
Yeah, I think that's probably what's happening there. It's a reflection on the so-called apokatastasis or restoration, whereas Protochrist is probably... The other name that they got was Tetradites. In other words, they had this view of an almost fourth person of the Trinity. And this is a reflection on the so-called pre-existence, pro-uparxis. So in this podcast, listeners have been treated to notions of, about pre-existence.
Yeah.
What's important to note is that there is two ways you can think of pre-existence. One is, what was my soul doing before it reached my body? And this gets into the question of cyclical worlds. But the one that the meaning of pre-existence that preoccupied the mid-6th century disputants was this notion of, what was there before there was a fall? What was happening in the noetic realm? And yeah, there seems to have been a doctrine that there was a henad in which all the Noes happily lived, and through some kind of satiety with God, they began to fall. And in the course of this, one of the Noes did not fall and united himself with God the Word, i.e. the second person of the Trinity, and became Christ, a Christ figure.
Procession and reversion. And it's like Plotinus's noose reverting toward the one and giving birth to the world of forms, right?
That's right. And this is rooted in an idea that is documented in Origen, that before the incarnation, the soul of Christ was united with God, the Logos. But what we see in the anathemas, 15 anathemas of 553, is a refined version of that story where it's not the soul of Christ, but a mind, before it even becomes Christ, that unites itself with God, the Word.
Hmm.
The details are very elusive because we're reading these through the prism of the anathemas.
Right.
Fortunately, it's a fractured but in places clear prism, because the anathemas, I have learned, are preserving this so-called libellus that the four monks from Palestine lodged against it. And it's possible, this is the work that I'm currently doing, it's possible to take the anathemas, the prefatory letter of Justinian, which survives in by quotation in two later Byzantine historians, along with a less well-known source by a certain George the Hieromonk, who wrote in the 7th century, who also preserves verbatim material that's parallel to the anathemas, triangulate them, and actually unearth the underlying source, which appears to be a classic florilegium of quotations. One of the unwritten rules in Christian polemic across the centuries was, give your enemies the worst, but always quote from them verbatim and faithfully whenever possible. And fortunately, I believe that that's the case here, that this libellus quotes accurately and we're seeing the fragments, but it probably quoted extensively from earlier authors. And what I'm doing currently in my current book project is trying to recover that original libellus, identify the sources, and identify who is responsible for the anathemas of 553. It turns out that the objects of the 553 anathemas are very different from those of the 543 anathemas.
Right.
The 543 anathemas were directed against Origen and doctrines that had been long in circulation since the 4th century. And it seems to have been effective, so the 543 anathemas, so effective that in that 8th session, dealing with the three chapters of the Council of 553, they just include Origen as one of a series of heretics you always condemn. Arius, he's in league with Arius,
right,
and Eunomius.
Yeah.
So it's a fait accompli by the Council of 553 that Origen is condemned in his person.
Yeah.
And the 553 anathemas, one is forgiven for thinking this is just revisiting old topics, because that's how it kind of starts out. You go through it, anathema 1, 2, 3, 4, and you say, you think to yourself, I've seen this stuff before.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you'll just kind of put it away. And that's a little bit too early. Wait till you get to anathema 7, 8, 9. It's all material that you have never seen before and has never been discussed either in the 4th century or the anathemas of 543. And that's where it gets really interesting. Who are these? Where are they coming from? I believe that Evagrius Scholasticus is correctly informing us that these are quotations from not Origen, but from Evagrius, Didymus the Blind, and Theodore Ascetus, and probably others.
Right, yeah. And you found some direct Evagrian echoes already, right?
This has been known, yes. There, it's been well known that several of the anathemas quote directly from the Cephalaia Gnostica.
Mm.
There are several places where there's just verbatim, very faithful quotation. As I've been unearthing this, or trying to restore this original text, I've identified a few more quotations, and Gabriel Bunga has also identified a couple more. So we now, I believe, can securely identify 8 quotations from Evagrius' Cephalaia Gnostica in this material.
Mm. So again, anti-originist misleading. It's definitely anti-Evagrian and anti a bunch of other stuff that is on the mind of these monks who are coming to Constantinople to say, Justinian, people are believing this stuff that we've put in this little book here, this little pamphlet. Could you make these all into anathemas? And Justinian says, yes, I will do that. That's the oversimplified caricature of what went down. So these are concerns about heretical beliefs that are abroad in the 6th century, in the Near East, in the monastic milieu. And some of it at least is Evagrius and Didymus type material.
Exactly. The proponents of this Libellus thought it's not enough just to condemn Origen.
Yeah.
We've got him, but they're just carrying on. We have to deal not just with the root of the tree, but the whole stock of it as well.
Mm.
And so they're trying to eliminate the reading curriculum that these monks were following, which included the Kephale and Ostica. From Didymus the Blind, we're told that he wrote Ipomnemata, in the words of Jerome, about the Periarchon, or first principles of Origen. And I believe that what we see in the Anathemas of 553 are some quotations from Didymus. I've identified a cluster of what I think are 9 faithful quotations from Didymus that I think come from a defense of and interpretation of Periarchon.
Mm.
In fact, this text that Didymus wrote may have been a popular way to first encounter Origen's text. The text, Periarchon's long. It's a good 4 books. It's not something that you read quickly. But if Didymus wrote a treatise where he quotes selectively from and then defends and builds on it, that would be a much quicker and easier way for somebody to get into the first principles, not only understanding what highlights to encounter when one does read the full text, but also what does it mean and how do you explain some of the more controversial topics.
In the anathemas, and again, the anathemas, the text of what was really in them, I think is going to be much more solid now that you've triangulated a lot of this data. But in the anathemas, what do we see vis-a-vis fears about people teaching anything like transmigration, notably angelification, serial angelification?
Yeah, well, it's a fantastic question. And in the spirit of the series, where we're looking at this whole question of what happens to the body after death and before life, I've already mentioned that in extracts 12 and 13 of the letter to Minos, Justinian takes issue with the notion that humans can be promoted to angelic ranks, or worse, powers may be promoted to humans, backed up by what he claims are extracts from Origen. Interestingly, those do not wind up as having any kind of counterpart in the 9 or 10 anathemas. So in the 9 or 10 anathemas, you do not have a condemnation of the change of bodies, humans to angels or demons. Similarly, in the 15 anathemas of 553, you do not have such a condemnation. The primary interest and concern of the anathemas is the destruction of bodies at the end of time, in the final age. That seems to be the number one concern of the writers of the anathemas, is that there is a doctrine that all bodies are annulled or annihilated at the end, which will be like the beginning, that it'll be just a pure henad of naked minds. That's their ultimate concern. Interestingly, they could have done that. And I've mentioned George, the hieromonk who wrote this history. There is an excerpt that he includes that is not included in the anathemas, where he does criticize and document, even among these people, a notion that after the incarnation, demons could advance to humans and angels. What will be interesting from this book project is not only what the 15 anathemas say, but what they opted to leave out. They were selective. Or maybe we don't have the full manuscript tradition of the 15 anathemas.
Right. So looking back on this discussion, this particular strand of Christianity that we see going from Clement to Origen to Didymus to Evagrius, and also to all of these unnamed monks and speculative Christian ascetics and whatnot, and to the Cappadocian fathers, like spreading out into Christianity in all kinds of interesting ways, right? This movement, in this sense, I think we're left somewhere like we were when trying to figure out Origen, his own Origen himself. Did he teach something like a transmigration? You can say no one's talking about animals, that's for sure. Do humans transmigrate into other humans? No evidence for that, as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. But do humans transmigrate, or do rational mm-hmm. beings move up and down the scale of embodiment to different realms, becoming angelic or becoming demonic, perhaps, depending on their merits? And can maybe demons be promoted to humans, be promoted to angels? That does seem to be on the table. Oh, yeah. For Evagrius and for this milieu more generally, right?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think the doctrine was widely and actively taught. I am not sure why it did not receive explicit condemnation. Certainly it gets condemned by the Orthodox. You know, I wouldn't want my indication that there's nothing in the anathemas about reincarnation to give... a basis for some people to say, okay, well, maybe Orthodoxy really teaches reincarnation. No, that,
right.
They want the spirit of things. They were trying to get rid of the whole thing, but it did not appear as an explicit part of the condemnations.
Hmm. Joel Calvis-Mackey, thanks for laying down your earlier research on Evagrius, where it meets your more recent research on this fascinating council, so-called anti-Originist council in Constantinople under Justinian. And this brings us to speculate on the future of this Evagrian Originist tradition in Christianity going forward. And I guess in one sense, it's clear that it already has become part of Orthodoxy in certain select ways, right? Like via the Philokalia and via the Cappadocians, and via a number of just Christian authors who didn't get condemned, who have ideas that can ultimately be traced back to this way of thinking, right? To Origen himself, or to this way of thinking. But what about the hardcore Evagrians? What is your sense as to what becomes of this movement in the future? I'm going to just go ahead and say, let us enter the realm of irresponsible speculation now for a moment and indulge ourselves. What happens to this movement within Christianity?
What happened after 553 to the readers of Evagrius? We don't know, but we do know that you could not have had a writer such as Maximus Confessor without some kind of healthy tradition going forward. Maximus Confessor has two pole stars in his writing. One is Evagrius and the other is Dionysius the Areopagite. In fact, Maximus will often quote wholesale from Evagrius without attribution, and is concerned about maintaining and moving forward with the ideas that Evagrius puts forward, obviously in an orthodox vein. But nevertheless, he's an active reader of Evagrius. In a writer such as Gregory Palamas, you have a reader of Evagrius.
Boom.
You have some of the fragments that we have of the Greek fragments of the Cephalaia Gnostica come from 14th, 15th century Flora Legia. So there were people who continued to read and maintain. It's not beyond the reach of... It's not in the realm of impossibility to speculate on there being some manuscript, Greek manuscript, where we have more fragments of the Gnostic chapters because people were reading them and were using them and copying them.
Mm.
So it becomes, what happens to them? Well, they integrate themselves into the Orthodox vision, but they bring as much Evagrius as they can with them into it. His ascetic works survive almost entirely in their Greek form. sometimes not even under the name of a different author. Usually you find reattribution to Nilus of Ancyra or Hesychius of Jerusalem. But some of the things he was just too well known for that you couldn't reascribe it to somebody else.
Right.
If Socrates Scholasticus has told us about the 100 chapters on the Practicos, well, you can't, you know, repackage that under a different name. And the work of uncovering this tradition is continued. I'm part of a conversation now about whether a rather significant work that's been attributed to Hesychius is actually supposed to be ascribed to Evagrius, which would add one new work to his oeuvre. It's not an esoteric work. It's a paranesis, it's substantive. It's about 2,000 words and would be a really interesting addition to it. But yeah, work continues on trying to uncover the works of Evagrius and his legacy, which seems to have been healthy even in the face of these explicit condemnations.
Like Origen, you say you don't want him, but you can't do without him. For a true Orthodox Christianity, you need Origen, you need Evagrius, as proven by Maximus, right? Maximus the Confessor, the most Orthodox of all Orthodox doctors, the gold standard.
That's right. Mm. And if Maximus was reading Evagrius, then, well, why shouldn't you if you're an admirer of Maximus?
Indeed. Joel Kalvismaki, keep it coming. Your work continues to enrich what we do, those of us who love Western esotericism, and be like the Evagrian readership at Constantinople throughout the first millennium and stay esoteric.
Thank you.